that you're here for this business, thank you.
Very much.
The House Water and Environment Committee will come to order. Good morning, another beautiful Oregon morning. We will have a work session first on House Bill 2463. Representative Crummell, if you're hearing, we are doing your bill. So I'm opening the work session on 2463. First thing I'd like to do, committee, is have Mr. Larry DeBates come forward. He was in the room when we had testimony on this bill. However, somehow we missed calling him forward, so I would like to give him that opportunity now. I believe you have his testimony that you've been emailed. And Megan has also submitted it to you. Welcome, Mr. DeBates, and our apologies.
Thank you, Chair Close and other committee members. I did submit my testimony after I missed a chance to testify last time. I submitted first an email, and then I followed that up with a hard copy. And my understanding, I wrote to everyone individually, so you all should have a copy. Essentially, what I said in my letter and what I'd like to reiterate again today is that I think any weakening of the water record provision for qualifying dwellings is a wrong step. Essentially, when 3661 was first passed, that permitted a lot of record dwellings. It sounds pretty reasonable. You give a chance for people that own property before 1985 to sign up and get that dream home that they've been thinking about. However, when it was applied on the ground in the area I lived in, I saw four landowners, potentially by switching deeds and so on and so forth, end up with 34 individual dwelling approvals. And I don't really think that was the intent. And one of the things that did kind of contain a little bit the development was this provision that now is being considered to being removed from the lot of record of legislation. That essentially stopped some of the development that was going out into farmland if they had to at least meet that, they had to have the small lots around them and two houses within a certain distance. So I just say to you, based on the past experience of lot of record application on the ground, anything to open more doors is just going to create the problem we already have. Now, I also heard Representative, pardon me for looking at my notes here, but who introduced the bill, Representative Crummell, essentially said that the county takes care of a lot of the infrastructure that's required for these developments. In Yamhill County, that certainly is not happening. And even within the last couple of weeks, the county rescinded a systems development charge that they had implemented about a year and a half ago that essentially charged system development charge for new dwellings in rural areas, in both rural and town. I know it's primarily rural. But anyhow, that generated $389,000 in about a year and a half. So there is quite a bit of building going out there. And when they rescinded that, they now are trying to figure out how to give that money back. But that was designed to pick up some of the transportation needs that are being created by the developments that are going on. A lot of those are a lot of record dwellings. If you have any questions, I'd be willing to answer them.
Question for Mr. DeBates. Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I see Representative Crummell. And would you come forward, Representative Crummell, with Harlan? And I believe you have some amendments you have prepared.
Yes, we do. You have the amendments?
Yes, we do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jerry Crummell, State Representative, District 27. thank you for putting 2463 back up on the docket. the Dash 3 amendments that you have basically narrows down the language that was originally in the bill. And the primary purpose for narrowing it down is so that we don't end up with urban-type development, I believe, in areas that are outside of the urban growth boundary. What it does do, and I think is a real plus for us, is that currently there's some confusion with the counties with regards to flag lots and how flag lots are not necessarily defined, but how the center of the lot is defined. And one of the things that the Dash 3 amendments will do is put into statute for the county's benefit how to find the geometric center of a flag lot. I think that's extremely important. The other thing is by being able to narrow down the language, there are still going to be a variety of other reasons why other property owners may or may not be able to take advantage of this. May not be able to take advantage of it if their property is in the forest, or if the uses around, and these are things that are already in the statute, if the uses around the lot are not compatible. So I think that there are still protections, but at the same time, this the amendments will allow for the counties to have a clear understanding in statute as far as how to find the geometric center. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions. Let me just go one more quick statement. I've been working with Harlan Levy from the Oregon Association of Realtors, and with Mr. Shriver, and with there's been contact with DLCD. My understanding is, and I guess this would be considered hearsay to a certain degree, but my understanding is that both the department, DLCD, and the Farm Bureau will be neutral on the bill with the amendments in place. So with that, I'll stop. Be glad to answer any questions, and or turn it over to Harlan or Madam Chair, whatever your pleasure is.
I guess, Harlan, maybe you could walk us through this where you've deleted 26 and 27, the new C section.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Harlan Levy, staff attorney for the Oregon Association of Realtors. The Dash 3 amendments that are before you today address an omission that is in the current statute. The current statute does not define center of the subject tract. And that has been problematic for owners of flaglots, such as Mr. Schreiber. What the amendment before you will do is it will define center of the subject tract, and it will effectuate the intentions of House Bill 3661. It is somewhat technical in that it is a geometric principle that we're dealing with here. A flag lot is a lot which contains a narrow strip, usually for access, which is adjoined to a much larger piece, which is generally where the house ends up going. It looks somewhat like a panhandle, frying pan with a panhandle would be a good description of it. And what we're doing with this amendment is we're defining the geographic center of the flag lot as the center of the tract. And the geographic center of the flag lot means point of intersection where two perpendicular lines that are drawn from the midpoints of the longest side of two long adjacent sides of the tract. It is kind of hard for me to conceptualize. I do have a large map. If you would like, I can show it to you on the map.
Would you like to use a black one?
Certainly. I think it might be appropriate for me to just ask Mr. Schreiber to show you how this amendment would work out. Joe, do you want to stay up there? Just, yeah.
Thank you.
Chair, person, representatives, I'm Joe Schreiber. This diagonally shaded area would be an example of a flag lot. Here we have a narrow portion which is joined to a public road and this section is the predominant area of the tract. What Harlan was explaining to you was two perpendicular lines. Perpendicular line would be something which is 90 degrees on either side of that perpendicular. And we're taking the midpoint of those. So in this instance, this would be the longest dimension here, and the midpoint would be at this set point. And this would be the longest section here, and the midpoint would be here. And when those two points are joined, then we have in this area the geographic center, as it was being described in the bill. Now, further on in that, if there are any houses across the road, and that quarter mile radius were to extend to that, those would be excluded. So all you're talking about would be whatever would fall within that quarter mile radius. Any houses that would fall within that would be counted, and either depending upon whether you need two houses or four. And much of the rest of this thing is based on the perimeter as well. So there are many factors that go into this. The length of time it is old, the perimeter factor, the number of houses that are within a quarter mile radius.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Are there questions from the committee?
I'm glad to answer.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Just as Joe said, I mean, this amendment to this bill really will not change the lot of record provisions. All the other requirements are still going to be in place. You will still have to have acquired the lot prior to January 1st, 1985. The lot must still be 21 acres or less in size. The lot must still be bordered by four dwellings that existed on January 1st, 1993. And you know, we worked with the department on, you know, getting this language together. The department was concerned with the circle crossing a public road, so we agreed to put a limitation in on that, so that, as Mr. Schreiber pointed out to you, if the circle ends up crossing the public road, any houses on the other side of the road will not be counted. This is a very narrow definition of center for purposes of a flag lot.
Thank you. Question? Thank you very much. Do you have anything to add?
Madam Chair.
Okay, committee, discussion on this amendment.
Do you need a motion?
I do.
Madam Chair, I'd move the dash three amendment to House Bill 2463.
Representative Jensen has moved the dash three amendment into 2463. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
I would move House Bill 2463 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Jensen has moved House Bill 2463 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Monica Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have received a lot of letters and emails on this particular bill, and I was quickly going through my file to see where they came from. And they've come from Bandon, they've come from Amity, they've come from Dallas, they've come from Albany. Some are retired farmers, most of them are farmers. And the main theme in this is residential development definitely is important to the state of Oregon, but when we talk about Oregon's economy, commercial and industrial, forestry and agriculture is far more important to all of these people that have contacted me. I think the short-range goal of this bill is to provide equity with those with property on which they can't build a long-planned home, as Mr. Schreiber has. But I feel the long-range implications are far more disastrous to the state of Oregon, in that houses would be negatively impacting resource lands forever after the equity need has been satisfied. And so I cannot vote for this bill. I do believe we need to work on land use issues and some of the problems that have resulted, but rather than focusing in on one particular parcel of land, I feel much better on working on land use change, in which we bring everyone across the state of Oregon, so it's not going to negatively impact our forestry and agricultural land.
Further discussion? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm prepared to vote for the bill if it turns out that we really need to do something differently with it. It would seem that another possibility might be to set it for some term of years and then see what the impact could be, but I'm comfortable with voting for it as it is.
Okay. Further discussion? Representative King.
I'm interested in support for the circumstance more from a standpoint that, you know, when a lot is surrounded by, you know, other primarily residential, even though it may be, you know, suburban, rural, profile land use, that the change in the measurement, I think, would be disruptive, and so I'm going to be voting no.
Okay. Representative Jensen.
I have no.
Okay. Do you want to stay with your motion?
Pardon me?
Do you want to stay with your motion?
Yes.
Okay. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Ford. Excuse.
Representative King.
I'm a no.
Representative Cruz?
Aye.
Representative Lee?
Aye.
Representative Morris
Anderson?
No.
Representative
Morgan?
Excuse.
Chair
Close? Both aye. Motion carries. And we need a carrier.
Yeah, Representative Crummel.
Mr. Crummel, would you like to carry your own bill?
I would be more than happy to carry this bill, Madam Chair, unless there's somebody on the committee that would like to carry it. But otherwise, I'd be happy to.
Well, you've worked so hard on this. I think we will give you the honor, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And close the work session on House Bill 2463. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2548. Can I explain? We'll have staff explain the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2548 originally prohibited use of income requirement for approved dwellings specified in a conjunction with farm and exclusive farming zone. We do have -2 amendment attached to your packet today, as well as the hand engrossed the bill with the -2 amendments in it, because the -2 amendments do delete the bill's original change prohibiting the use of income requirement and focuses on the issue of dairies, establishing that dairies are an important part of Oregon agriculture, specifies that different standards for reviewing the primary and accessory dwelling customarily provided in conjunction with a dairy farm, and requires that Land Conservation and Development Commission adopt rules to provide these standards for review of providing dwellings on these dairy farms because of the special situation that they find themselves in.
Thank you. Representative Butler, would you come forward and explain the -2 amendment to it?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's my pleasure to return today. I'm honored to be able to be before you with the -2 amendments. Let me just, if I may, introduce a little bit of additional testimony and information. One of my county commissioners from within my district wrote me following the original presentation of this bill and indicated that they had made a calculation. There's only two crops grown in eastern Oregon that could meet the income test anyway in gross dollars, and that was onions and potatoes within the Treasure Valley. And perhaps some other specialty crops. I'm not sure whether that includes marijuana or other cash crops like that, but We do occasionally grow squash or gourds or something like that on a small acreage that you might be able to meet the, if you had 80 acres worth or 100 acres worth, might you be able to get to a $80,000 gross income test. He said the only way one pays for anything in farming nowadays is with net dollars, and current ag prices are just not many net dollars. If a person is moving to a business from one area to another, such as a nursery or a dairy, there's no way the person could commute for this two-year time period given the amount of money expended for the facilities and operational costs. And he asked for some loosening of the noose that is frequently tied around the necks of our agriculturists in Eastern Oregon. I would like to further this quote from a February 21st letter that I received from Vic Benner, the director of the DLCD. Director Benner and Ron Eber and I had met. He said, with respect to dairies, this is, again, a February 21st letter of 2001. With respect to dairies, there is no question that they need on-site labor to manage and operate the dairy once the milking and related facilities are constructed in order to start the dairy operation. Although this matter could be fixed through amendments to the commission's administrative rules, a statutory change would be more direct and limit what would be a controversial and time-consuming policy debate before the commission. So as a result of our meetings, some suggested changes came forth, and the House Bill 2548-2 amendments, as your administrator has just referenced those, it adds a section extolling the benefits of dairies and the importance of having folks that work on dairies be there because they are labor-intensive, and then allows the Section 5 allows the conservation DLCD to consider that Section 4 when it adopts rules that provide standards for review of a primary and accessory dwelling customarily provided in conjunction with a commercial dairy farm. Notwithstanding any of the administrative rules establishing a gross farm income standard, the rules adopted in this section shall allow the siting of a dwelling on a commercial dairy farm prior to the dairy earning any gross farm income. And there has been a concern expressed that they'd like to see the dairy up and operating before the homes go up. I submit to you that, again, income is not the way that we should be defining farms. It should be the commitment to farm the operation, and before anyone would build a home, they would be in the process of building the dairy, would have already had the necessary building permits necessary to construct the dairy, would already have the necessary issues relative to the soils, the water, and the other issues already scoped out, perhaps be invested as much as several hundred thousand dollars before the first spade of dirt is turned over. And based upon that, certainly as the dairy process goes forward and permits are issued for the construction of the dairy, it would be appropriate to, in conjunction with the dairy, to go ahead and build a home or homes that would be necessary to build a dairy at a time before the dairy is necessarily actually producing income so that the cows are can be acclimated and so forth. And it might even be appropriate to have homes there as the construction is ongoing of the dairy itself. However, I trust that the commission will come up with necessary rules to define what is a dairy operation, and will take into consideration that those who have invested time and energy and money to go ahead and construct or prepare for the construction of the dairy and get the building permits and those kinds of things will take into consideration the cost that they've got at that particular time in order to bring forward the residences necessary to operate the dairy. Again, the concern is that we have concern for Oregon's environment and our farm and ranch communities where we do grow high quality hay in the valleys of the mountains in eastern Oregon, where our high protein hay is much more valuable if we can utilize it on our farms and ranches there, rather than shipping 8 to 10 truckloads of that hay out in order to generate one truckload of milk. It's better for us to be able to ship one truckload of milk and into a dairy operation in northeastern Oregon than it would be, or in western Idaho than it would be for us to be shipping out our hay. So with these amendments, I think that they address the issues that are of concern, and I encourage the your committee, Madam Chair, and members of the committee to take into serious consideration the concern that I have that we're moving towards a time when it'll be cheaper to come to the legislature and lobby to build a home on a lot in conjunction with a farming operation than it will be to spend the tens of thousands of dollars that will be necessary to go through the lobbying at the local county commission and the planning commission and those folks before they eventually give up, throw their hands up in disgust, and have to come and spend the thousands of dollars it takes to get a building permit directed and addressed by the legislature itself.
The questions for, pardon me, Representative Butler, Representative King.
I'm expecting that that if you have a dairy and it's that the properties that you're talking about would be able to support the quality and quantity of grass, you know, to support you know, having a dairy, you know, right there. It's my understanding you do have to have a good supply of grass real close by. It's not all the, it's not all trucked in hay that'll support that. Is that true?
Madam Chair, Representative Close, our dairies are becoming much more specialized organizations, and no, you wouldn't have to have a field of grass adjacent to a dairy in order to sustain the dairies of today. Normally, the dairies of today will be dry lot operations, and that's probably the best way to operate a dairy would be on a hillside with a dry lot with a catch basin below it. And so very likely that within the confines of the deed for the actual dairy operation itself, that you would have a relatively small acreage, something under 100 acres, which would allow for the dry lot, loafing sheds, feeding mangers, and those kinds of things, storage for the hay and other nutrients which would be given, as well as the milking barns and so forth. So typically, you would locate that dairy then adjacent to fields of alfalfa hay and those kinds of things. We're still talking about, nonetheless, in the agriculture area.
And a second question, Madam Chair.
Oh.
In reading your amendment, I don't see anything about the investment. And I would be interested to see that there's, you know, some commitment to investment. You know, certainly that's something that, you know, could happen under rules process. But I think it makes some sense to, you know, then going forward that we're putting in something that says more than someone's said, I want to be in the dairy business and build a house first and then decide, well, they don't want to be in the dairy business anymore. That, you know, I would think that making that financial commitment of investment is, you know, is a real moment of truth in terms of saying what you're trying to accomplish here is versus creating, you know, what could be a loophole in the way.
Madam Chair, Representative King, I would like to respond to that. Thank you very much. And that was an issue that with Director Benner and Mr. Eber, we did discuss the potential of someone coming to town and investing very small amounts above ground in order to establish a residence. And I believe that there are statutory provisions that address those issues already. However, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to make sure that I read in a portion of the letter from Director Benner with respect to the dairies. There's no question that they need the on-site labor management to operate the dairy farm once the milking and related facilities are constructed in order to start the dairy operation. Now, I'm assuming that relative to the construction, and this would be my encouragement for the DLCD before they manage to make the rules, that if there is an application to proceed with the construction of the dairy, again, hundreds of thousands of dollars can be expended before a spade of dirt is turned in order to make sure that you have the soils content and those kinds of things. And at that point, it's typical that wells will have been put down and those other investments would have been made, then that the rules would contemplate that simultaneous with the actual issuance of the construction permits to build the dairy operation, that the homes could certainly be the home and or homes for the dairy owners and operators could then be issued simultaneous with the operation. We did talk about a certain dollar amount above ground. Again, I have confidence in the DLCD that the amounts that are invested to make a dairy operation, so the very, very last sentence, excuse me, in Section 5, notwithstanding any administrative rule establishing gross farm income standard, the rules adopted under this section shall allow the siting of a dairy, of a dwelling, on a commercial dairy farm. So, siting of a dwelling on a commercial dairy farm prior to the dairy farm earning any income. And in other words, you're going to have to milk the cow before you get the milk in the tank, before you get it delivered, before you get your two-week check for the dairy. And in order to do that, I've got to have a dairyman there at least for the first 2 weeks to get the cows milked before I get my first dairy check. And so I have confidence that the DLCD will address that particular issue.
I still don't see anything here that requires an investment, and I also think that, you know, a point that you're bringing up is real fair, that it would be unfair to have the dairy person invest the hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars and have the equipment and you're ready to go, and then LCDC or the county say, well, no, and you're stuck. That would not be fair either. So it seems like having some circumstance, whether it's bonding, et cetera, where the authorization can be made at the time of commitment, even if that's, you know, prior to construction. But I also think that, you know, when you go, you know, downstream and the agency is dealing with the issues, that they're going to be under pressure for rulemaking, saying, well, it's either not being fair because they're not, you know, letting me go build on the land, et cetera. And so I think that their rulemaking would be under more pressure than would be, you know, what would be in statute. So just because, you know, they might have an intent originally doesn't mean that can't be eroded later. So I would like to see some kind of authorization versus commitment, you know, if that could be in place.
Representative Butler, would you expect that when someone came forth with a proposal for a dairy, that the way this could work is that the house would be written into that plan?
Yeah, Madam Chair, typically what happens is that before the dairy and what brings this bill forward, that the import brings this bill forward at this time, is the fact that the people had actually purchased the ground and started the construction of the dairy and had expended literally hundreds of thousands of dollars in preparation for the construction of the dairy and all of the infrastructure, concrete and those kinds of things, before they realized that they weren't going to be able to build a home. And so in response, Madam Chairman, it's typical for people to believe that they would be able to site their homes in the master plan. And certainly their master plan and the permits that they would be obtaining would normally have the homes in. Now, in the past, they have not been able to get they didn't need the permits to buy the land to drill the wells, to do the groundwork in anticipation to find out that they could proceed with the dairy. It isn't until they start to build the commercial structure above ground that they start getting their permits. It's at that time that they've got so much involved and invested that they realize that they can't get the permits for the home at the same time. And so that's where we're running into the problem. It isn't the fact that they're rushing out and building three or four homes and then saying, well, this would be a good place for the dairy. It's quite the opposite is true.
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Butler, I live in a district, I serve a district that is, you know, going to be, I think, affected or potentially affected by the bill that you have here. And I'd like to express my appreciation for bringing it forward. But am I correct? I've got three dairies going in out on the BAIC property, and they will be housing in the neighborhood of 65,000 cows. they'll be producing in the neighborhood of 267 tons of manure per day. But they have problems at the present time building a home there where they can be have on-site supervision of this facility. Is that what I understand the current law to be?
Chair Close, Representative Jensen, it's my understanding that presently if there's not a home, a dairy home or milker's home, worker's home that's presently associated with that dairy operation, that they would have some difficulty obtaining a building permit relative to the actual dairy itself, based upon the fact that it hadn't produced $80,000 worth of dairy income for the preceding 2 years. And that's the very reason why this bill is brought to you today, is to go ahead and anticipate that in construction with, and again, these are all, as the chair has mentioned, these are all part of master plans. You don't rush out and build the homes and then decide that you're going to put a dairy on it. No. Almost exactly the opposite. Similar to your situation that you're mentioning, Representative Jensen, that the plans go forward to construct the dairy and the master plans that are needed, because this is a very labor intensive or a very capital intensive investment, and it's a very labor intensive business once the dairy is up. And so it's important that synonymously with the and contemporaneously with the construction of the actual above ground facilities for the dairy and the improvements that are being made in preparation for the dairy, that because they are so labor intensive and because they are very capital intensive in their very nature and subject to some degree of potential theft and vandalism, that there be people on site at an early time in the construction of the dairy. And I again want to reiterate to the members of the committee, there's nothing in this proposal that attempts to thwart the establishment of residences in rural areas under the guise of going to or mind order for a dairy. I have in mind of ordering a dairy up when I'm done here. This is in conjunction with a commercial dairy operation, and that's I have every confidence that without lots of additional statutory changes, that the rulemaking process already contemplates what a commercial dairy is, and that the statutory process already protects us from anyone trying to do the reverse play on this particular piece of legislation.
Right. May I call in? Yeah. I genuinely appreciate that, Representative Butler. And I mentioned the manure simply for purposes of with any dairy that you're going to site in the state of Oregon, you're going to have a substantial investment in waste disposal before you get anywhere off the ground with anything else you're doing. That's going to be, and in terms of dollars, you know, the dairies that I'm talking about, obviously large dairies, but we're talking not hundreds of thousands, but we're talking millions of dollars that are going to be spent to do that before they do anything. So, but even with smaller dairies, they're still going to have a huge investment before they even get around to thinking about putting milking barns in.
Chair Close, Representative Jensen, you may be aware we call that underground subterranean system where they have the catch basin for the dairy operations, and certainly those go in well before any above ground construction go in at a substantial cost. But we call those honeypots where that waste is originally trapped and settled, and then from there after the settling process, then it is, and in the particular instance in your district, actually, there's going to be a huge, an enormous benefit to the state of Oregon and to the green energy in the state of Oregon as a result of these millions of pounds of solid waste that will be created and be able to be utilized back in organic methods after the methane gases are extracted from this particular waste stream, creating I don't know how many megawatts of electricity will be generated off of it, but it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And again, that is all below the ground before before anybody drives a nail above ground so far as being able to construct anything. And that's why I bring this out, that the reverse will just not happen. Regulations and rules are in place to make sure that a commercial dairy is a commercial dairy.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Seeing no further questions, we'll call the next witness. Marilyn Fiskus from Jefferson County. Who would have dreamed that dairies would be part of our energy?
Madam Chairman, my name is Marilyn Fiskus, and I live in Culver, Oregon, Jefferson County, right in the middle of the state. And I might have a whole different perspective on this. I just found out about it just a couple of weeks ago. But we have two pieces of property, actually two tax lots. It consists of 22 acres total. There was a house on it at one time, and it burned along about 1980. And there's a shop, electricity, you know, the whole shooting match, but I can't build a house on that and farm the property too. It wouldn't take any property out of production. And I've been traveling around up around Sherwood and Boring and wherever, and I see all the old berry farms are gone. There's houses there. I see up around Sherwood all of the filbert trees are gone. There's houses there. I don't want to do that. I'm the other side of the coin, where what we want to do is put a house in the middle of our property where there was a house at one time. Even landscaping is still there. And live on the property, and I can go out and change the wheel lines and enjoy the 360-degree view. But like somebody else said, and I was already told by the county, they probably would throw me in jail for growing what I have to grow to make $80,000 on that 22 acres. So just being a small country person, there's a whole different side to the coin. I'm not going to have hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of cows and things. I just want a house. I don't want to subdivide it. I want to live in the middle of it. And I have my letter here that I emailed to everybody, and I've also put an aerial map of the property on there showing where the house was and where the house would again be. And I firmly believe a lot of the farmers in our area have new houses, and I think there are many ways to, I call it cheating, it's not really, I agree wholeheartedly with them. I don't want to do that. I want to do it because you say I can do it. They can combine incomes from various pieces. They can buy high-dollar animals, llamas, or whatever, and sell high-dollar animals and whatever. They've done it, and they can build their house because they've done it. I don't want to do that. I just want my hubby to get his paycheck from Cecil and come home and help me pound nails. So I have this, and that's all I have to say.
Could I ask you, Ms. Fiskus, did you say what you're producing on your land?
It's alfalfa hay right now.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what city in Jefferson County are you nearest to?
Nearest to Culver. Culver is about 35 miles north of Bend. And actually, the property is right at the gateway to Coast Palisades State Park, which is another comment I might make. Life was kind of a thorn in my side. And on the way down to the Cove State Park, there's a campground, and it used to be called an overflow campground, about halfway down the hill. And on this bench of land, there was a farm. Well, the state came along and bought this 148 acres adjacent to this campground. They're telling me they're going to farm that land. And I'm saying, I don't think I believe that, guys. Well, they didn't farm it last year. It remains to be seen this year. But why would the state buy 148 acres of farm ground? You know, just why? And I maintain if they can do that and not farm it, why can't I have a house in Steel Park the same amount of land? So
has the state built any buildings on that?
Not yet, but I went to a presentation the other night, and I was supposed to go to one tomorrow night in Madras about them saying what they're going to do. They kind of skirted around the property the other night, so I don't know.
Interesting.
I know when they do start digging for anything they're going to build, I am too.
And I wouldn't blame you. Questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Committee, just to explain, we are calling people forward that live more than 100 miles from Salem first, because they've come a long distance. Mike McCarthy.
Thank you. My name's Mike McCarthy. I'm from Parkdale, Oregon in Hood River County. I raise apples, pears, cattle, hay, and timber. And I'm here today to support strong land use protections for farmland in the state of Oregon. I do not believe that now is the time to weaken farmland protections, either piecemeal or completely. I oppose House Bill 2548. It's part of many bills that will negatively impact the ability of surrounding farmers to efficiently carry on farming practices. We do not need more homes in the farm zone. This is particularly true in our county, where we have very parcelized, very high-income farmland, and it's very parcelized right now as it is now, and we don't need any more parcelization. We don't need any more homes in the farmland that will impact farm use. We need to work to maximize the efficiency of farming, and the way that we can best do that is maintain large parcels of farmland. There's the very big differences in the efficiency of farming depending on whether they're small parcels or big parcels, and that's something we really find in our area. And we don't need to have this farmland broken down anymore, and farm dwellings are a real problem for us. On the farm dwelling test, I was part of the committee of LCDC back a number of years ago that tried to look at farm use tests to really determine when a dwelling will be in conjunction with farm use. And we looked at numerous tests, and we finally came up with the income test. And I was a part of the committee that recommended that, and I still believe it's the best test. There may be other possibilities, but to really determine if somebody's actually farming to make a living, the income test is really the only way to go about it. And I would like you to stay with the income test, the $80,000 income test, and if anything, increase it slightly. We still have a number of people in our county that try to get around that test. One way they get around it, for one particular example right now, is they buy nursery stock, bald and burlap, they put it on their property, they wait a year, and then they sell it, and they do that two times, and then they qualify to have a house. So I think, if anything, we need to put further protections into the income test to prevent people from abusing it. Thank you.
Could I ask you a couple questions? Suppose you have a farmer who's making $40,000 a year growing grass seed or mint, for example. And each year they make $40,000, maybe they make $35,000, the next year maybe they make $20,000. Why shouldn't they be able to have a house on the property?
Well, I think in a lot of cases there's opportunities for them to have a house either on the property or near the property. You know, we find in our county there's a house on every 25 acres, I think. So even if you don't have a house right on your particular piece of property that you're now farming, it's not that difficult to get a house on another piece of property near it and continue to farm it. And I think that's probably the case in the Willamette Valley, too. There's a lot of opportunities where you can buy another piece of farm ground or lease a piece of farm ground that has a house, existing house on it.
Questions?
Yeah. Representative Cruz. Mike, how many acres of apples would it take to generate $80,000?
20.
Okay. What would be the capital investment to be able to maintain those? tractors, sprayers, stuff like that.
On 20 acres?
I mean, the same as if you had 100, wouldn't it?
Yeah, $50,000 or something, yeah. Right.
Okay. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, I mean, there is a... And I understand the protection of farmland, and I certainly support that, but we've also set up a system that kind of prohibits folks from actually even getting into the business anymore, just because by the time you buy land and buy equipment and stuff like that, you got such a heavy debt load with a marginal business, it's awful hard to make it. And I've struggled for a long time with how somebody brand new can get into the ag business without a lot of capital on the front end, without starting out really small and kind of growing as they went. So didn't necessarily have a whole lot to do with the bill, because obviously a dairy farm is a lot larger scale than that, but I've known him for a long time.
Well, I understand the problem, but I still think in most areas of Oregon that there's a lot of houses in the farm zone that can be made available for farmers to live in, very near where they farm, and oftentimes they can lease a piece of ground, additional ground that has a house on it, and live there for the short run until they figure out a way to get the income necessary to put the house where they want it.
Thank you. Call John Schaefer, Polk County.
Thank you. I had not prepared any written testimony, which apparently was a good thing because I don't have the dash two amendments. But I'd like to make just one comment, kind of pursuant to what Representative King was addressing. It seems to me that he and Representative Butler were on two different sides of the issue. Representative Butler, I think, was assuming a good faith effort by an applicant who really seriously intended to put in a dairy. So getting permits and so on would be an appropriate benchmark for that sort of person. What concerns me is the person who says, I'd like a building permit for a house, and I'm going to build a dairy someday. And going back a number of years when they had the farm plans in order to build a house on an acreage, the person would have to go in and work out with the county a farm plan. Those things never got carried out in a number of cases. The guy got his house, and the farm plan was kind of forgotten about. So I would... like Representative Butler, I think the ELCD will do a good job of coming up with some kind of criteria, but I would feel a lot more comfortable if the committee expressed its intent that there be some kind of actual physical construction or, you know, something that makes the intention of the applicant clear and makes it a significant commitment, rather than just saying, well, I'm going to build a dairy someday. If you have that in the bill, if you express clearly the intent, I think that would be an improvement in my mind. And that's really all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Are there any questions for him? Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, Mr. Schaefer, and I appreciate you didn't have the amendments, and I understand that, but I do believe the intent that you're talking about, or what you're talking about, is in the bill, because or in the amendments. And I think we'd all be nervous about, you know, the hypothetical thing of somebody saying, I want to do something and then go build a house, and then 40 years later, nothing has happened, you know. Sort of thing.
That was abused,
yes.
And that was the standard, and the income has made a significant difference in that regard. It's cleaned up the process a great deal, I think.
If I may, the amendments call for on a commercial dairy farm, not on a proposed commercial dairy farm. We're talking about, I think, a very specific situation there, so.
Yeah, it, I heard that, and I was thinking an operating commercial dairy farm might be a more positive way of expressing it, or, you know, that probably goes too far, but you get my drift, I think. But how do we define operating? And so, you know, any clarification, any way to make intent more explicit is, I think, would be a help. Thank you.
I think we all agree that there may be some people, but we hope not, that would try to get around the law by saying that they're going to do this and then not do it. But with the oversight of DCLC, this should be avoided, I would think.
We can hope.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll go ahead to the next person, Cliff Kennedy from Albany. Did I say that right?
Cliff Kennedy.
Kennedy, sorry about that.
I am Cliff Kennedy, a recently retired farmer from Benton County. I got up at 4 o'clock this morning to prepare some testimony, and I sat there. I realized I was becoming discouraged, and I wondered why I was going to overwork my one finger on the computer. I think I know why now. I'm just mostly going to say I support what Mr. McCarthy said. His testimony was real good. I would have said, he probably said it better than I would have. And Mr. Schrader, he gave good testimony. I'd like to respond to a question that Representative Close asked. I understood her to ask, what about a farmer who is, he said income fluctuates $35,000, $40,000 a year. Well, my response to that is, $35,000 to $40,000 a year isn't enough farm income to build a house to start with. Even with $80,000 gross income test, you have to be operating up in the 50% profit margin to be able to build a $17,000 house, assuming 8% interest. And to qualify for a bank loan, your mortgage payments cannot be more than 28% of your net income. So for somebody making $80,000 test, you got to be operating in a 50% margin to be able to build a house. So, you know, the $80,000 test is peanuts. I've been telling these committees for years and years, ever since 93, that the $80,000 is peanuts. It should be up to $300,000. Representative Cruz, I guess, was asked a question, too. Can't recall it anymore, but my answer would have been pretty much the same. Anyway, we need things tightened up, not loosened up. And what people are, I want to support the dairyman too. I think he has a point, and I would be comfortable giving the department some discretion on making some exceptions on cases like that. This is what happens when I don't have my testimonial written out. Anyway, thank you.
Can I ask you a couple of questions,
sure.
Mr. Kennedy? What is your land primarily in, cropland?
We've raised, for 40 years, we've raised beans and sweet corn. For 31 years, we raised strawberries. And my son now is getting into grass seed crops and vegetable crop seeds. On a small scale.
Are you able to grow 300,000 on your land?
Grow what?
Are you able to grow 300,000 on your land?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, not every year.
Okay. Thank you.
I know that blows a lot of people's minds, but farming isn't all that easy.
Sure. Thank you so much. Okay, Larry DeBates, Amhill County.
My name's Larry DeBates. I live at 20630 Southeast Polk Lane, rural Amity. I did not have the amendment either until this morning. Essentially, my position would have been that anytime you try to open up more and more land to homes in the rural area, I think it's a mistake unless it's absolutely needed and tightly controlled. I guess what I see here now, and everybody seems fairly comfortable with it, I have really no objection. I'll leave it more to the professionals to tell you whether it's a good bill now or not. But I would also say that, as Mr. Konecki said, you know, I still fails in my thinking. The first thing you do when you go out and want to start into farming, if like Representative Cruz said, is to put up a $200,000 house is your first investment. That kind of tells you that maybe that isn't the intent of somebody going out there to farm. So I think the income test is essential, and I hope that this legislative session recognizes that and keeps it in place. Thank you.
Thank you. Carrie Kirshner, Thousand Friends.
Good morning, Chair Close, members of the committee. My name is Carrie Kirshner. I'm a staff attorney with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I prepared some background testimony that is reflective of House Bill 2548 as originally drafted. I still think it provides good background material in terms of the income test in general, and we'll point to it a little bit, but we'll address the amendments that have been presented this morning. As I testified previously, 1,000 Friends of Oregon was opposed to House Bill 2548 as originally drafted. We're not opposed to the amendments as I understand them now, but I would like to echo some of Representative King's concerns that this exclusion or exception be tightly drafted towards bona fide commercial farmers, that really we are indeed keeping in mind that this provision of the statute is for dwellings in conjunction with farm use only. It doesn't relate to houses in farmland or on farmland. It relates only to those dwellings that are in conjunction with farm use. I understand that people pointed to certain sections of the rules that may already exist to provide adequate protections. I've not reviewed those. Certainly, we expect to be able to work with the LCD and LCDC in drafting any rules concerning dairies and create additional protections if necessary. I appreciate some of the comments that have been made in terms of what do we do to really be able to analyze, is this indeed a dwelling in conjunction with farm use? One of the benefits thus far of the farm income test has been that it is a clear and objective test that is easy for counties to apply. It's also easy for applicants and property owners and property purchasers to be able to assess before they make any investment whether or not they might be able to have a home and to develop their farming operation. Therefore, I would certainly commend this committee consider some policy directions to, one, show a particular level or type of physical above-ground investment before perhaps the building of the farm dwelling can occur. Two, to provide some sort of enforcement mechanism such that if indeed the master plan, and we hope that people do indeed have good faith in carrying out their master plans, but should we have a scenario where the dairy is actually never built, that there's actually some provision for removal, you know, of the house. Or some other mechanism that would create more than an incentive, but an enforcement action for others to ensure that this land is left in the production of agriculture. I would also note that in some of the income test rules applying to Eastern Oregon, there is already a test which counties can adopt, which talk about the capability, some demonstration that the land is capable of producing a certain gross income, and I would recommend that that be something that this committee or that LCDC itself write into any such rules that are related to dairies. I will say, having noted those three areas, those are issues that that I came up with as I was listening to others' testimony. Where, you know, 1,000 Friends of Oregon is not in a position right now to be offering any specific amendments, but would expect to be working with others in the future to do that. My last note will be that Mrs. Fiskus, when she came up, or Fiskus, I apologize, when she came up, she spoke to certain abuses that are actually already happening with the income test, and other farmers have identified those as well. I think that we need to heed those calls when we direct LCDC and others to develop new exceptions for farmland to make sure that we are cognizant and taking care of those abuses that we know to occur and carefully draft things to avoid such future problems. I thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I guess I just have one comment, and that's that I think I would also say that when our citizens feel they are forced to deceive and break the law to be able to live, then we need to look at those laws and see if they're equitable and fair. Is there a gentleman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you be, 1,000 Friends would be so generous as to accept, you know, $10 million worth of underground development as being sufficient for your income? Nothing above ground, but underground.
Chair Close, Representative Jensen, I think that that's certainly a very high threshold. I think it needs to be specifically, as you suggested in some of your comments and inquiries, directed towards the dairy-type operations, which do certainly include, waste disposal and other types of investments that are specific to that particular kind of industry.
And if I could, I believe that is specifically what this bill addresses, isn't it? Is the dairy industry with the amendment that we have at the present time in front of us.
Chair Close, Representative Jensen, I agree, and I wanted to take the opportunity to address particular issues that I think we might find in creating rules and commend income tests in general as being a good tool for the protection of agricultural land in Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ron Eber, ELCD. And you have the amendment.
I have the amendment. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Eber. I'm the Farm and Forest Land Specialist for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. As Representative Butler pointed out, both the director, Mr. Benner, and myself worked with him on the development of this amendment. And we are supportive of it when we have looked at the issue of dwellings and farm zones. As you've heard, it is difficult to tell at sometimes when a dwelling is truly in conjunction with a commercial farm operation. The current standards that require prior income, as Mr. McCarthy pointed out, do give you a good indication when someone is actually farming. With respect to dairies, it's real clear, and we have seen when people get additional farm dwellings, and many times they are with dairy operations, that there's a significant investment that is made in the equipment and the animals that's far greater proportionally than the cost of any dwelling, and that when you look at the policy number 2, which is on page 1, lines 14 to 17 of the bill, where it talks about part of the reason of requiring the continuous on-site labor is not only to operate the dairy but to protect that investment. It's clearly the intent that we see behind this and the rules that we would develop that investment would precede the actual construction of the dwelling or the issuance of the permit, that the dwelling approval would be conditioned on a certain level of investment or prior issuance of permits or whatnot for the dairy. We think that the safeguards can be put in place. It's one we came to the income test because of prior abuses that were found when people just did management plans. It's one thing to go out and plant a number of acres of Christmas tree seedlings, which is a very small investment relative to a house, so that someone then going and building the house can just plow those under, and we found that to be the case many times. We don't see that occurring with in conjunction with the dairy. Someone's going to put a significant amount of planning and investment into how you set up a dairy. It's not just a matter of putting the seedlings in the ground. It's a complex operation, takes a lot of equipment. And so we're confident we can do the rulemaking and keep the safeguards so that there isn't any abuse.
Appreciate you working with Representative Butler on this. Questions? Thank you.
I might add one final point, Madam Chair, real quickly. There was mention that there may have been or are abuses of the current income standard. I have heard anecdotal stories. No one has ever brought to the department's attention any specific, I do know of one questionable one, but no one has ever brought a specific instance to our attention where someone deliberately misrepresented the case and got a dwelling under the income standard where the income was not in fact earned, that I'm aware of. That doesn't mean someone has done it, but I'm not aware of it. So
in the case where someone buys a llama and sells it or two llamas, that's not breaking any of your regulations.
Madam Chair, no. The rules do require that with respect to livestock, you must deduct the purchase price of the livestock from what you sell it for, so that it's with respect to livestock, it's a net income test. That is similar or the same as for getting farm assessment, because there were cases where people would go to the livestock yard, they'd buy some livestock, sell it, have receipts showing some gross income, and yet the animals maybe never even got to the farm. And so the farm assessment laws made that differentiation for livestock. So we have the same provision in our rule.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Thank you so much. Next, we'll have Jim Welsh.
Good morning, Chair Close and committee members. I am Jim Welsh, representing Oregon Family Farm Association, and we support House Bill 2548, and we know that it has been, that it is a very narrow bill presently, and we will take up our argument on the 80,000 income test probably on Friday. We have a bill up, and we'll talk about it there, but We do understand and represent the smaller family farms, and we appreciate Marilyn Fiska's testimony here and what she ran into. These are some of the things that private property owners in this state are concerned about, and property rights is one of those things that Oregon Family Farm Association hold very near and dear to them. And as we listen to some testimony here in the support of this income test, we're concerned, of course, about how it was developed, the fairness of the issue, and government telling private property owners what they can and cannot do on their property. We know that natural resource industries, property owners in that industry, want to make a living on their land. But what we have established in the state of Oregon under land use is far too restrictive. And the fears that we have been established, been written about, publicized, highly publicized in the state, we don't believe will come to pass to the extent that we've heard them, certainly in the press and before committees year after year here in the legislature. We would like to see fairness tests be established in protection of private property rights well ahead of government telling us what we can and cannot do. And we will be back here again on Friday to talk about this some more. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Welch, for your testimony. Is there any questions for him?
Just quickly.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, I understand that you are supportive of the bill as amended, as you understand at this point.
Yes, right. We are.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. The next person is Larry George.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Larry George, Executive Director of Oregon Needs in Action. We represent farmers, ranchers, and other rural property owners in the state of Oregon. We're supportive of House Bill 2548, both in its original form and with its more narrowly drafted amendments. It looks like to me the amendments are very narrowly drafted, and so we don't have any opposition whatsoever in drafting that way. We will be back on Friday to discuss a little bit more about another bill that has a broader application. I don't want to go on too much because we're all going to discuss this again on Friday, but fundamentally we view historically there was an income standard attached to the state statute that currently says a dwelling customer is providing conjunction with farm use. The legislature in 1973 affirmatively removed that income standard, and if you listen to the testimony at the time from the committee that removed that income standard of $500 on the parcel, the reason is because the concept behind land use system was to keep the land in production. And the best way they viewed that is to have somebody living on the land. What you find a lot of times is absentee landowners don't actually farm the property. So you have property that's in a farm zone that's not being farmed because nobody is there to actually farm the land. And we obviously view the income standard as fundamentally discriminatory against people who do not have large amounts of income. The vast majority of small farmers in this state are, in fact, if you look at the Census of Agriculture, the vast majority of farms in this state have other income outside of agriculture. And that's just the nature of Oregon agriculture, which is small and diverse. So we'll talk a little bit more of this on Friday, but as far as these amendments, they're fine, they're narrowly drafted, and we don't see a problem with them. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. Okay, that completes our testimony on this bill. So I'm going to close the public hearing. Committees, we're missing several people, so I think we will move the work session to another day on this bill. I'm going to,
Madam Chair?
Representative Cruz.
I just wanted to point out for Representative King, if he will look on of the Handling Gross version on page 4, on lines lines 29, 31, and 36, there's a word yurt, and oh, he's not here. Right here. Well, I'm just going to point out, I mean, before Representative King and his good work last session, yurt was never in an Oregon statute, and now it is because of him. And,
well, thank you for pointing that out. I had not noticed the word yurt. And I'm glad to know that. Is there anything else for the good of the committee?
Well, that wasn't for the good of the committee.
Thank you all for testifying, and we are adjourned.